298 billion pounds sterling. When you hear a number that size attached to a defense announcement, your first instinct as an aviator is to ask what they're building. Your second instinct, if you've spent any time watching government budget cycles, is to ask how much of that money actually exists. I'm Tower. This is ATIS, your aviation news brief on Radio Hangar. Before we get into the details, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. The United Kingdom has published its defense investment plan, and the document is generating exactly the kind of reaction you'd expect from something that promises a great deal and explains relatively little. Former Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer released it publicly as one of his final acts in office, framing it as the largest sustained funding increase in British defense in a generation. £298 billion over the next 10 years, with annual defense spending targeting 2.5% of gross domestic product by 2027? That's the headline. Let's work through what it actually says and where the questions are piling up. First, some context on where the United Kingdom has been with defense spending. For most of the post-Cold War era, the UK was comfortable near 2% of GDP on defense, which put it at or just above the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, benchmark. That figure came under real scrutiny after 2014, when Russia's annexation of Crimea started reshaping the conversation about European security. Then came the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and the 2% target shifted from a benchmark that alliance members debated to a floor that serious members were scrambling to hit and credibly defend. The UK was nominally at around 2.3% in the years following the Ukraine invasion. But defense analysts pointed out that the real figure, when you stripped out pension liabilities and other items that inflate the headline number without reflecting frontline capability, was closer to the NATO minimum. There was a credibility problem that matters when you're trying to lead an alliance and simultaneously arguing that European nations need to do more. To understand why the real versus nominal question matters so much, it helps to know what British defense investment actually looked like in the decade before this plan. The 2010 Strategic Defense and Security Review made dramatic cuts to UK military capability. The Nimrod Maritime Patrol aircraft was retired, leaving Britain without a dedicated maritime patrol capability for years. One of the two new Queen Elizabeth-class carriers was nearly sold off before it had completed sea trials. The Harrier fleet was retired prematurely. Those decisions saved money in the short term and cost capability that took more than a decade to rebuild. And in some cases, the institutional knowledge, the training pipelines, the qualified personnel, they don't come back just because the budget does. That is the context in which this defense investment plan is being read. When a government announces a large number and that number doesn't survive contact with the actual budget process, the damage is real and lasting. The question is not whether $298 billion is an impressive figure. It is. The question is whether it reflects genuine political will to reverse a decade-long trajectory, or whether it is aspirational at the headline level and subject to revision when the next chancellor presents a budget. Here is where the scrutiny matters most. $298 billion over 10 years sounds like a massive commitment. The question that defense analysts and journalists, including the team at The Aviationist who published a detailed breakdown, are working through is how much of this represents new money versus reclassified existing spending. This is a documented pattern in government budget announcements. It isn't unique to the UK, and it isn't unique to defense. A government announces a large headline number. When you break it down, a significant portion represents commitments already built into previous budgets, inflation adjustments to ongoing programs, long-term contracts that were already signed and being fulfilled, and spending that was always going to happen but has now been given a new label. None of that is inherently dishonest. Governments consolidate spending announcements all the time, but it means the net new investment, the money that genuinely represents new capability being added to the force, may be substantially smaller than $298 billion. Until the UK Treasury publishes a full accounting and parliamentary committees have reviewed it line by line, that headline number should be treated as a ceiling, not a floor. Now let's talk about the element of this plan that is genuinely significant for aviation. The sixth generation force design component. The UK is one of three partner nations in the Global Combat Air Program, known as GCAP. The other partners are Japan and Italy. The program is developing a sixth-generation multi-role combat aircraft intended to replace the Eurofighter Typhoon in UK and Italian service, and the Mitsubishi F2 in Japanese service. Initial operational capability is targeted around 2035. The aircraft spent several years in its concept phase, under the name Tempest before the program, consolidated under the GCAP banner when Japan formally joined as a partner. It is one of the most technically ambitious military aviation programs underway anywhere in the world right now. To understand what sixth generation means, it helps to be precise about what fifth generation was. The F-22 Raptor and the F-35 Lightning II defined fifth generation fighter design. All aspect, low observable stealth, internal weapons carriage that preserved the stealth signature throughout the mission, active electronically scanned array, radar, and sensor fusion. The ability to integrate data from multiple onboard sensors and networked sources into a coherent picture the pilot can act on, rather than managing each sensor system separately. Fifth generation wasn't about any one of those capabilities in isolation. It was about combining them into a system where the whole was significantly more capable than the sum of its parts. The pilot flying an F-35 isn't manually integrating sensor inputs. The aircraft does that. The pilot sees the picture. Sixth generation takes that baseline and adds capabilities that were experimental or theoretical when fifth generation designs were locked in. Directed energy systems, high-power microwave and laser-based defensive systems designed to defeat incoming missiles with potentially offensive applications as well. The physics work, the engineering challenges around power generation and thermal management at airborne scales have been the limiting factor, and those challenges are being actively worked. Hypersonic integration. The aircraft is designed from the outset to carry and employ hypersonic weapons, meaning air-launched vehicles flying above 5 times the speed of sound, operating in a flight regime that makes them extremely difficult to intercept with current defensive systems. Artificial intelligence-assisted decision support. The processing demands of sixth-generation sensor fusion exceed what any human pilot can consciously manage in real time. AI systems handle the background processing and surface the most actionable information while keeping the human pilot in command of the engagement decisions. And then there is the loyal wingman concept. This one deserves some time because it represents a genuine shift in how combat air power is structured. The idea is that a crewed sixth generation fighter operates in coordination with unmanned combat air vehicles that it commands. Those unmanned vehicles execute tasks directed by the manned aircraft. Forward reconnaissance into contested airspace, electronic warfare and jamming, weapons carriage that extends the manned aircraft's magazine depth, or absorbing adversary radar attention and weapons fire. The crewed aircraft commands the formation. The human makes the engagement decisions. The unmanned wingmen extend the reach and survivability of the overall package in ways a single crewed aircraft simply cannot. The UK has been developing its loyal wingman concept under the Mosquito program, built by BAE Systems. That aircraft has flown. Whether the Defence Investment Plan provides sufficient, sustained funding to bring that capability to operational maturity alongside GCAP on a timeline that makes them useful together is one of the questions the document raises without fully answering. What makes sixth-generation programs this expensive is partly the aircraft itself and partly everything that isn't the aircraft. Ground-based mission systems, battle management networks, low probability of intercept data links that allow assets to share information without advertising their positions, the adversarial threat modeling that tells you what the aircraft needs to defeat in 2035 and what it might face in 2045, the training infrastructure for pilots who will command both crewed and uncrewed elements simultaneously, the logistics and sustainment chain for a platform that will fly for 30 years after it enters service. You can build the most capable fighter in history and deliver it into a support ecosystem that limits what it can actually do. The history of military aviation has examples. Sixth-generation programs are explicitly designed to avoid that failure mode, but only with sustained, predictable investment across the entire system, not just the airframe. The war in Ukraine has added a layer of urgency to those requirements that wasn't there before. What Ukraine demonstrated is that low-cost unmanned systems can achieve effects that previously required expensive crewed aircraft. Drones operated by both sides struck strategic targets and influenced the ground battle at costs that conventional air power could not match on a per-sortie basis. At the same time, Ukraine made clear the limits of drone-only approaches, the vulnerability to electronic warfare, the difficulty of sustained complex operations without human judgment in the loop. The continued relevance of crewed aviation for missions that require adaptability and decision-making at speed. Sixth generation design is responding to those lessons directly. The loyal wingman concept isn't theoretical anymore. Ukraine made the operational logic concrete. The emphasis on electronic warfare integration, on the ability to degrade adversary sensors and communications while protecting your own, is written into sixth generation requirements in ways that reflect what the world has been watching unfold in real time. A program that doesn't absorb those lessons will not be relevant when it enters service in 2035. Now, the UK's current aviation commitments matter here because GCAP doesn't exist in isolation. The UK operates the Eurofighter Typhoon in Tranche 3A and 3B configurations. It operates the F-35B, the short takeoff and vertical landing variant of the Lightning II, from the Queen Elizabeth-class aircraft carriers. That carrier strike capability, built around HMS Queen Elizabeth and HMS Prince of Wales, represents a power projection capacity the UK has not had at this scale since the end of the Cold War. The UK's F-35 story is instructive about how budget pressure shapes long-term capability decisions. The original plan involved both the F-35B for carrier operations and the F-35C, the conventional carrier variant, which required catapult and arresting gear on the carriers. Budget pressure drove a decision to standardize on the F-35B, which required modifying the carriers with ski jump ramps. That decision constrained what the carriers can operate and foreclosed some coalition options with catapult-equipped allied carriers. It was a budget decision that looked from the outside like a capability decision. That is exactly what near-term budget pressure looks like when it's applied to long-term capability planning. It's precisely what sustained, predictable funding is supposed to prevent. Whether this defense investment plan actually delivers that sustained funding is the question. The international partnership dimension of GCAP can't be understated either. Three nations with different procurement timelines, different domestic industrial interests, and different parliamentary budget processes have to stay aligned for this aircraft to reach operational service. The UK's credibility as a reliable funding partner affects the confidence of Japan and Italy in the program. An underfunded UK contribution doesn't only affect British air power. It affects whether Japan views GCAP as a viable long-term alternative to acquiring additional F-35s, and whether Italy can justify the domestic industrial participation that makes the program politically sustainable in Rome. Credibility in multinational defense programs is its own currency. You lose it once, and the next program is harder to build. So what does any of this mean for the broader aviation community, including general aviation? The connection between military aviation research and what eventually appears in GA cockpits is real. Though it moves slowly, the glass cockpit revolution that transformed general aviation in the 2000s, terrain awareness systems, synthetic vision, advanced weather integration, much of that traces its lineage through military and airline development pipelines. The sensor integration and communication architecture being advanced under sixth generation programs will migrate into civil and general aviation in ways we can't fully predict, but can reasonably expect. More immediately, the UK aerospace industrial base is one of the most technically sophisticated in the world. Companies like BAE Systems, Rolls-Royce, Leonardo UK, and GKN Aerospace, plus a deep supply chain of smaller firms doing precision manufacturing and systems integration. When that industrial base is well-funded and working on technically demanding programs, it sustains the engineering workforce and the institutional knowledge that keeps aerospace advancing. When it operates on uncertainty about whether announced funding will actually materialize into contracts, that workforce erodes in ways that take a generation to rebuild. You cannot recreate skilled tradespeople and systems engineers by reopening a budget line 5 years later. The defense investment plan is partly a signal to that industrial base. Here is what is being planned. Here are the programs to hire for. Here is what the workforce needs to look like. Whether the signal is backed by real appropriations is what program contract awards and annual budget submissions will show over the next several years. The milestones worth tracking. GCAP contract awards for the detailed design phase will be the clearest indicator of whether UK funding is real. The Mosquito Loyal Wingman program and whether it advances to operational demonstration will show whether the ecosystem beyond the airframe is being taken seriously. UK defense budget submissions over the next 2 to 3 years will tell you whether the 2.5% target is being funded through actual appropriations or held as an aspiration. One more thing worth noting. Starmer released this as one of his final acts as Prime Minister. That framing, a significant policy document published on the way out, can mean two different things. It can reflect a genuine legacy move, cementing a commitment the next government will have to honor or explicitly reverse, or it can reflect a desire to claim credit for a number that the incoming administration will have to fund and defend. Only the UK parliamentary budget process will sort out which of those this turns out to be. The plan is public. The commitments are stated, the questions raised by the aviationist and others are legitimate, and the answers will come not from the document but from how the money actually moves. I'm Tower. Sources for today include the aviationist and publicly available UK government documentation on the Defence Investment Plan. Find us at radiohanger.com. Stay heads up.